Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, a special Wednesday night episode. I am Jamie, and we have Jerry and Chris here too, fellow movie geeks. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
What a ha ha ha.
How's everybody doing? How's the week been for you guys?
It's been interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, have you guys watched a lot of movies?
Well, Chris?
I have not watched a lot of movies. I've been watching, you know, I'm always watching something, you know. I'll pause it, turn it off, maybe go back to it later. I'm kind of in the middle of To Catch a Thief right now.
Oh, well, you're doing much better than I am with that alone.
Yeah, great. It's such a great movie. I haven't seen it in years, but it's just like the most like lighthearted, fun Hitchcock movie that there is, I think.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I've watched a couple of movies myself, and I have about four more to watch that are here at home. But last night we watched Disturbia, which is a really effective movie. That movie works like gangbusters. I mean, it's great because it seems to be a throwback to, well, you mentioned To Catch a Thief. It seems to be a throwback to those kind of older generation of thrillers that didn't rely, like today's movies, on torture and that kind of stuff. And it just works so well. And I also watched Hot Fuzz.
Oh, good.
Which I really enjoyed. I thought it was great. But Chris and I were actually talking about it, and you know, there's a different dynamic when you watch comedies in the theater with a crowd and then at home. Comedies, more than anything else, it's the infection of the laughter,
right,
that gets to you from the crowd. I remember years ago watching The Birdcage in an empty theater because we worked at the movie theater, and we screened it the night before it opened, so it was practically empty. And I thought, you know, the movie's fine. It's just there wasn't a single laugh-out-loud moment in it. And then I watched it the next night with a full house, and all the way through it, it was just a riot. And it's amazing how differently comedies play.
That's a good example to
use. It can go the other way, too. You know, like, you can laugh with a big audience and then watch the movie a couple years later and be like, what the hell is this? Like,
yes.
I laughed at this? Like, you know.
Yeah.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, and there are all kinds of different kinds of comedies. I think that, I think The Big Lebowski, which we've certainly talked about a lot in the past, you know, it's unique in that it contains all kinds of comedy. The really kind of sophisticated highbrow and the lowest common denominator kind of gags, too.
Yeah. I put Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead in that category with those, with Lebowski. They get better every time.
Oh, that's a very good point. I agree, Chris.
Every kind of comedy, like Jamie said, every type of comedy is represented. And
yeah.
The more you watch it, the more you laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a few good belly laughs in the Hot Fuzz film, and that's more than I can say for most comedies out there.
Yeah.
Sadly,
it's got the witty comedy, and then it's also got a shot of the main character kicking an old lady in the face. you can't ask for more than that.
That's right.
And it was very surprising how over the top it is, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because it's parodying these movies that are so, take themselves so seriously, and, you know, how the violence is over the top. And I mean, it was a surprising movie, too, for me to watch. So.
Yeah.
But
I
have
Timothy
not yet.
Dalton's been that happy in decades.
Who hasn't?
Timothy Dalton. I think it's the first time he's just so happy to get work and be on the big screen. I mean,
yeah.
He was so happy in that movie.
You're not a fan of Beautician and the Beast, Jerry? Is that
you know what's really funny about that, Chris, is like I tried to watch that on Showtime when it first came on.
Ugh.
I dozed off.
Oh, man.
But I tried.
I was, I worked at a theater when that movie was playing. I walked in and watched 5 or 10 minutes of it. I was like,
Yeah, it's the only thing more menacing than his take on James Bond.
Harsh. I can see the angry letter coming from Timothy Dalton tomorrow morning.
Oh, I knew some ladies that were just over the moon for Timothy Dalton, man. He was like it for them, and they obsessed over him. I'm sure they were card carrying members of whatever fan club he had.
The Lion and Winner fan club, but
yeah. So let's get to the big movie from this past weekend, and it was the best performing film in history for the month of August, and that's the Bourne Ultimatum, the third Bourne film with Matt Damon, which I have not yet seen, but you two have. And so Jerry, let's start with you. What was good about this last one? What made it an excellent entry into this film series?
Well, it made an excellent entry, but let's go back to the old. This is very ironic that we talked about Paul Greengrass on our first show.
Yeah.
We were talking about the shaky cam and how that's not popular with a lot of people, and there's a lot of shaky cam with this movie. But I would never have known that this is the director while watching Bloody Sunday. God, it's been 5 or 6 years, I guess, on Sunset Boulevard watching Bloody Sunday, that this guy would turn out to be one of these great directors who can do no wrong. And with four films to his credit now, two Bourne films and United 93 and Bloody Sunday, I trust Paul Greengrass to take me wherever he wants to take me.
Yeah.
And I think the Bourne series has done something...
That sounds slightly gay, by the way.
Well, okay. Well, you know, I'm not going to argue that. I'm not going to even go into that because, you know, you're looking at someone who's, for their favorite movies, has pulled out like 20 DVDs and 10 VHS tapes. So,
right.
Let's
yeah,
not
Paul,
go
Paul
there.
Can, Paul can take me wherever he wants to go.
Was that who
whatever
can take?
He just said.
All right,
okay,
never mind.
Go ahead. Back to the beginning.
I know, I can see I'm going to have to go listen to this show again. but it's just, we this summer especially, the trilogies, the third movies have fallen apart. They've been kind of disappointments. They haven't been the home runs that a lot of people thought they would be. This one is a home run, I think, in every sense of the word. I've read some negative reviews, but I think...
Have you really? Who's given it negative notices?
I've read some on the internet. I've read some, not negative, but people say, while it's great action and it never lets up, that Matt Damon's character is soulless. There's not a lot invested in Jason Bourne. I disagree with that personally, but I think I have to say something. As much as I know you guys weren't crazy, Jamie, you weren't crazy about Casino Royale, but Casino Royale was good because of these movies, because these movies forced James Bond to get back on his A game, sort of. This movie is going to, I hope, will make James Bond even get back more on his A game with the news I've heard recently. But I have to say, this is one of the finest trilogies I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't.
And intelligent action films made for adults. I mean, made for someone that appreciates, you know, an intelligent film.
Absolutely.
You know, there are a series of films that don't cater to the lowest common denominator, but they don't sacrifice the thrills that you find in those other types of action films.
You don't have a chance to rest during this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Chris, what were your thoughts?
I couldn't agree more with everything that Jerry was just saying. I was a big fan of the Bourne Identity, and I'm a big fan of Doug Liman. I think he can do no wrong. Everything he jumps around in all these different genres and just nails it every time, in my opinion, and definitely did with the Bourne Identity. So when Bourne Supremacy came out, I liked it. I enjoyed it a lot because I happen to like these movies. I like the character. I don't think he's this one-dimensional character, and I've read some
not at all
to Jerry. But I was a little bit, I wasn't as crazy about the shaky cam, because the Bourne Identity was not like that. It didn't have a lot of that handheld, intimate
that's true.
Action scenes that Supremacy did that Paul Greengrass is so good at filming. It was a lot slicker, it was a lot more, just standard action movie, but Bourne Ultimatum kind of meets in the middle somewhere, I think.
Right.
And really, really just there's no other way to say it, just fucking delivers.
Yeah.
I mean, the crowd I saw it with loved it. I was, my girlfriend and I loved it. We also watched the first two before we went to see it, so that definitely helps a lot too, as far as enjoying it and really being into it.
Yes.
And this one actually even plays off of the end of the second movie.
I know, it picks off immediately. I mean,
right. It picks up, and then later the movie ties back into things that happen in the second movie just very brilliantly. But the thing I got to say that works, we've said this stuff about how it's an intelligent action movie, and it, you know, doesn't appeal to the lowest common denominator. And those things are true, although I actually think that the movie gets more credit for being, it gets credit for being smarter than it actually is. Really, I mean, it is a pretty standard action movie. It doesn't have much of a plot, but the writing is smart, and the characters
are
smart.
Right.
But what works best about it for me is Matt Damon.
Oh, his role.
Oh, my God. This guy can do no wrong.
He owns it.
He got all these accolades in the beginning of his career, you know, with movies like, you know, Good Will Hunting, of course, he got nominated for, and Talented Mr. Ripley. And
Courage Under Fire.
Courage Under Fire and The Rainmaker, and he's great in those movies.
Yes.
But as he goes on, and we've talked about this before, you and I, Jamie, he is just becoming one of the most dependable actors, not only for an audience, but for a studio. It was released today. I read an article saying he is
the
most bankable star for studios.
Yeah.
For every dollar that they pay him, the movie will make $29. He's number one as far as bankable stars.
Mm-hmm.
He's fantastic in it.
He is.
You can't take your eyes off of him. He's such a good actor in movies like this and The Departed, where he's been ignored. His performance in that movie was totally ignored.
I know, I don't get that. He was great in that.
I'm very sour about that, too, because when you first watch The Departed, I think we discussed this months ago, when you first watch it, you're taken by DiCaprio's performance.
Yeah.
Because he's filled with such angst, and, you know, he takes up a lot of your focus the first time you watch it, and of course the spectacle of Nicholson in a Scorsese movie.
Yes.
But upon reflection and watching it again, Matt Damon's performance really takes hold.
Yeah, Wahlberg, Nicholson, and Leonardo DiCaprio—they're all great in that movie, but they're all kind of hitting the same note. Whereas Matt Damon is playing a whole different tune.
It's very subtle, and
it has
layers that are not as obvious to you just upon first viewing.
Yeah, and he's also very good in The Good Shepherd.
Yes.
He is superb in The Good Shepherd. He's the anchor of the movie.
And he is one of those guys that is not showy. You know, he doesn't have to put on a limp or put on a disguise or something.
Right, right.
Go extroverted. He is a subtle actor.
I honestly believe, though, that, like, I can't get too upset about The Departed snub, even though I am upset. I honestly believe, and when I walked out of Bourne Ultimatum, I was thinking, this guy is so consistently good. I doubt that he's more than 5 years away from, you know, from a performance that really just has no chance of being beaten for the best actor.
Right.
Right. No, I agree with that.
I'm talking like a Forrest Whitaker, Last King, when it's like, oh, yeah, some of these other guys, they were really good, but everybody's kind of nudging the person next to him going, but you know, Forrest Whitaker's going to win it. I think that Damon's got one of those in him not far away at all.
Oh, I would also like to go back in something that Chris said about Doug Liman. It's very good that you brought it up because I was reading the same book of interviews of directors, and Doug Liman is responsible. The Bourne Identity is like his baby. He was the one who wanted to do this, wanted to make this into a movie beyond what we're used to when we were growing up with the ABC miniseries based on Robert Ludlum books. He really wanted to bring this, make this a big action film, intelligent action film. And Damon was the one who came to him and said, look, you know, I have two duds under my belt right now. I need a home run. If you can't do this for me, I'm screwed.
He was not in a great place in his career. Still a very young career, Matt Damon, and because he had just been coming off of kind of consistent flops.
All the Pretty Horses and The Legend of Bagger Vance didn't do him a lot of justice in the world after Good Will Hunting.
And the advanced on Bourne Identity
movies.
Was terrible.
Underrated movies and underrated performances, though. Those are both pretty good performances from him.
Right, right. Oh, I don't disagree, but that's just where he was at that time.
Yeah,
right.
And then the advance word on Bourne Identity was awful. They were saying that this is going to be a big dud. It's terrible.
Someone said on Ain't It Cool News, I'll never forget this, he's no Richard Chamberlain. So, you know, and I think they ate their words on that one, but I think it's safe
wow.
to say that.
Well, actually, it's the sentence just takes on a whole different light. No, he's no Richard.
That's Jackson. Right.
He's something else entirely. I mean, he owns this. I put his performance in those movies up against any Bond movie. It's hard
I agree.
To compare.
Chris,
hard
I agree 100% with
movies.
That.
Oh, yeah. It's very easy to take these and put them up against Bond movies, Bond and Bourne. I mean,
Bond, as Pierce Brosnan said it best, I read this in an interview, Pierce Brosnan said, Bond is stuck in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that was the whole problem with attempting to update that character, because it's a character that its appeal is, and
very
who that character
oriented.
Is stuck in the 60s.
The only upsetting thing is now they're basically, Damon has said he's done making these. And even Paul Greengrass said, jokingly, that if they were to make another one, it would have to be called The Bourne Redundancy.
Well, I did hear them talk about the possibility of a fourth one.
There are books. There are new books that are being written, but I don't know if they're
right,
more
but Matt
loyal
Damon
to
said,
the book
Matt
than to the film.
Matt Damon said it would probably be better. His idea of a fourth Bourne Identity film would take place 10 years later, 10 years from now. And he said, but the studio probably wouldn't want that. They probably wouldn't even remember Bourne Identity in another 10 years.
He's got right. a good point
they
there.
They want to capitalize on it right now because it just pulled in $70 million over the weekend. Guys, we have a caller.
Okay.
From a 586 number. I'm going to patch them in. 586, go right ahead.
Hi there, guys. How's it going?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. My name's Todd Andrebarna. I'm the host of Liberty Cap Talk Live here on Blog Talk Radio. And I noticed you guys were on, and I thought I might just, tune in. And I caught a little bit what you were talking about regarding the Bourne Ultimatum.
Yes.
And I had seen the Bourne Identity and the Bourne Supremacy, and I will tell you right now, those were great flicks.
They mm-hmm. are. Absolutely.
They were just outstanding. I mean, Matt Damon, you know, he has become one of the best actors in the industry. I mean,
I think he really has, and I think, like Chris said,
I think he's shined, he's blossomed into very much like a 21st century Humphrey Bogart, in a sense, you know.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
I mean, he is. I mean, he's in fact, you know, I think of Ben Affleck as the Jimmy Stewart and Matt Damon as Humphrey Bogart. So
yeah, and you know, I think that Ben Affleck gets a bad rap, but personally, I think he's a very talented guy that doesn't really, until lately, doesn't really have very good decision-making skills.
But he was good in Hollywoodland. I have to give him that.
No, I think he's making smarter choices
yeah.
now. I think he has suffered from one too many bad choices.
Right.
I think Hollywoodland, he's great. He's directing his first film, Gone Baby Gone.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, and the advance reviews of that have been stellar. But I think he's very talented, too. But Matt Damon has kind of very subtly worked his way up to the top ranks of film actors now. And he really can't be beat. I mean, he's just sensational.
He is. He is. You know, I think that, Ben Affleck made some very iffy choices, I mean, as far as, you know, the kind of scripts that he chose to go with. But, but you know, I think that, like anything else, I think Ben will completely rebound into something, you know, fabulous. I mean,
yep.
you know.
I think he has, though.
I mean, it was sort of like the same thing with John Travolta back in the 80s when his career went into the toilet, and then he resurrected thanks to Pulp Fiction. So
right.
And he keeps resurrecting every couple of years. I mean, he's the luckiest man in the business.
Yeah, he's one of those guys, and hopefully Ben Affleck won't suffer. And Burt Reynolds is another one of those guys, one of the top stars in the country, or the top star in the late 70s. And then he goes into obscurity, making all these terrible movies, and he has terrible PR. Then he comes back for Boogie Nights, or comes back for Striptease and Boogie Nights. He's on top again. He has a real shot.
Oh.
And then he goes back to the direct-to-DVD movies.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that Ben Affleck, once he gets back in the game, which I believe he's almost there, and I think so, too. I think this new directorial project will put him up there. I hope he's smarter and more calculated in his choices I think his problem was he was looking for the blockbuster. You know, he wanted to be a big action star, and I think that backfired.
I think so too.
Because I don't think it was coming from a sincere, creatively fulfilling place, and I think that he admits that readily.
He admits a lot, actually. I mean, it's amazing what he'll say in an interview.
Yeah, he's very open and forward, and I think people respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you guys can quote me about what I said about Matt Damon, but you know, it's funny. I think that Matt is going to go places. I mean, he and Ben have been wonderful pals, you know, over the years. But I think that there is a certain down-to-earth quality about Matt Damon. You know, he's a very, very, very talented guy, and he knows his stuff. And I like the, you know, I think that this movie, The Bourne Ultimatum, is probably going to, you know, push him to the edge of you know, being the best actor of our generation. You know, he's, you know, I mean, I would love to see him and Travolta in a film together sometime. You know?
That would be very interesting.
That would be interesting now, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
you know, I mean, I think that they should work together. I think, you know, the chemistry between the two of them would be just pretty amazing.
I think so, too. And I think that Travolta is an amazing actor. I think that he's doing projects that are beneath him. I mean, they're still very popular. I mean, Wild Hogs is a very popular, entertaining movie, I'm sure. But I think we lose sight of the fact that he is an exceptional actor. He has done exceptional work.
Yes, he has.
In his career.
Yeah, I think that his current project, Hair, which is already out in the theaters right now.
Oh, the Hairspray, yeah.
Hairspray. I saw the original John Waters film, and honestly, I mean, I'm sure he did probably a pretty decent job, you know, pretending to be a chick in this one, but
yeah.
I don't know. I can't really imagine John Travolta in a pair of high heels. I mean,
it works. Actually, it does work. It's the best thing he's been in many years, to be honest with you.
Does it work partly because it's hard to imagine him in that kind of dress?
No, the problem is I can't imagine him in that. But I guess people are comparing him to Divine, which is, no one is Divine.
Yeah, Divine is just...
Divine's in a class, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not like he's doing a remake of Tootsie, you know. It's, you know, Dustin Hoffman sort of, you know, actually brought the cross-dressing thing, you know, in
right.
the spotlight. And this is before Mrs. Doubtfire. So,
well, actually, if you want to go back to that, it's Some Like It Hot is still the best of all of those.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, and you got to admit, too, that John Waters' films are cutting edge. They really push the edge of,
yes.
of, you know, especially early on in his career, of bad taste, because he just wanted to get people
Shocked.
In the theater to see his films. So the Broadway version of Hairspray, and as a result, the movie version, is a little bit anesthetized from the
yes, it
original
is.
John Waters.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I think, you know, imagine with John Waters doing something, you know, completely off the wall, and I know that he did a Dirty Shame, I think it was.
Yes.
Which I know got pummeled by the MPAA and with that stupid NC-17 rating, and
right.
I really wanted to see that film because I think, oh, okay, so it got an NC-17 rating. Of course, you know, he had to chop off some scenes in order to get the R rating, but
yeah.
But I know that you know, he's one of the most unique directors. I mean, you know, I wouldn't exactly put him in the same category as, say, Ed Wood of the 1950s, but he's sort of, you know, a little bit different.
Yeah, I think that he's definitely a unique voice in cinema, and you know, and we need more people like that. I mean, more people that don't fit the typical mold of.
He breaks the mold, my friend.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Dirty Shame, I mean, the one thing when I walked out of the theater, I'll never forget, I was like, this man has lost none of his edge.
No,
yeah.
He hasn't. No, and he's hysterical, too.
Oh, he is.
He's one of the best interviews you'll ever see. I've seen him in lots of interviews. He's always consistently one of the best interviews, not just because he's funny, and he is.
Right.
But he's also very knowledgeable about films and filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
And really kind of a film historian. He knows.
You get the sense that he's somebody that would be incredibly entertaining to sit and talk to for a couple of hours just to hold a conversation.
Everything.
And so many of these people making movies today seem so vapid, like you wouldn't be able to hold a conversation with them. But we've gone from Matt Damon to John Waters, and that's an interesting progression. But can you tell us what time your show is on and where we can find it?
Well, it's a politics show, completely different here. But
we love politics.
We love politics, trust me.
Oh, well, it's on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Okay.
Next week I have a particular writer on, on the war in Iraq, and we also have a two-hour season finale show, and I'm already renewed for a third season, so it's actually doing pretty good.
Oh, wow. Where can we find it?
It'll be blogtalkradio.com/LibertyCapTalkLive.
We will be listening in. That sounds like a really cool show.
Also, and for a treat for my listeners out there, I've added a chat box so that if they have like any questions they want me to relay to my guests I interview on the show, please do. Make it more interesting. Just to beef things up on there. So.
Oh, that is an exceptional idea.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I did put it on there today because a friend of mine was suggesting it to me. I'm like, oh my God, that is an absolutely great idea. So it's already on there, and people can chat away.
Okay, well we'll be listening in, and I appreciate your call so much.
I just want to make one more thing, and then I'll let you guys go. But
sure.
I have a business partner. We're starting an independent film company.
Oh wow!
So we can go into the indie movie business, but. We hope that it will grow into becoming a lot like Lionsgate or even, another studio like, I'm trying to think here.
New Market.
It's great,
Well, when that gets up and running and
you'll have to come back on the show.
More information, please, yes.
Yeah, because we have some scripts in mind. I'm already working on a script myself, and I'm also an actor myself. I'm trying to get back to the game myself, so.
Terrific.
So it would be great. It would be fantastic. I'll give you the guys the details on some of the scripts that we're working on.
Please do send them our way, and we'll relay them to our listeners too.
Oh, so,
thank you so much. I guess he isn't there anymore.
No, I don't think he is.
just right before we get to our guest this evening, who is on the line for us, so we can do our critical roundtable discussion of some of our favorite films. That's going to be a lot of fun. We have a couple of announcements about future guests. This Sunday, we're working out a call from John Ottman, who, for anyone who might be unfamiliar, is a really famed film composer. He's composed most of Bryan Singer's films. He's composed the new film, The Invasion, with Nicole Kidman that opens this weekend. But he's also a film editor. And he's currently in Berlin. He's working on the score and editing the new Tom Cruise film, Valkyrie, for Bryan Singer. And he'll be calling from Berlin if we can find a way to do it reasonably with something that doesn't cost him an arm and leg to call in. But that's what we're currently working on. And we're also we're in correspondence with Rob Zombie to try to get him on the show in the next week or two to talk about Halloween. And I just received an email from someone, I'm not going to reveal who, but someone from the crew of Indiana Jones 4 who has responded to my interview request, and we'll try to get him on too, and we'll give you more details as they begin.
So we at least know the sex of that person.
Is a man.
Thank you. No, I mean, it helps me figure out who it is.
I don't think you can.
All right. I was trying to be like all sorts of Sam Spade, but okay.
Yeah, it's not Harrison Ford.
But I didn't think it was Harrison Ford.
It's pretty close. It is someone who often doubles for Harrison Ford. I'll put it that way. Yes. So tonight, our guest tonight is Karen Beach, a.k.a. Diva Soul Sista. You can find all of her film criticism, which is great, by the way, at divasoulsista.com. That's DivaSoulSista.com. I hope I spelled that right. And she's also a very accomplished screenwriter, a short film based on one of her scripts, P.N.O.K., Primary Next of Kin. It's currently making its rounds on the festival circuit. It's a movie that deals with the war in Iraq, and it stars Danny Glover and Irma P. Hall. So this is a real great film that we need to all look out for. And we're just so honored that she agreed to join us this evening. Miss Beach, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Your reviews are fantastic. I've had such a good time reading through all of your reviews on your website.
Thank you.
How long have you had this website, and how long have you been reviewing films?
I've been reviewing films informally kind of all my life. I'm always the one people say, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? So I started the site because, as you said, I'm a writer, and I started it just to kind of get some more writing. I've just had all this writing in me that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I started the site in November of 2003, pretty much just as a labor of love, as something that I wanted to do. And it's pretty much grown since then, since it's just me. And more recently, in the past year, my friend Thomas has joined me.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess he's the diva soul brother.
yeah.
So we have really about 400 reviews on the site.
Oh, wow.
I love the site.
It's very comprehensive, and it's great to look through it. And I love reading film criticism. It's, you know, it's the geek in me. I just I do it in my spare time. That's how kind of geeky I am about movies. But tell me about the short film that was based on one of your scripts, The Primary Next of Kin. How did that come about?
I actually spent a couple years in L.A. Trying my hand at the whole screenwriting biz.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was over there, my best friend's fiancé at the time got sent over to Iraq.
Mm.
And it was pretty much the closest that I've personally come to really knowing someone that's been on the front line. And sort of just watching what she went through on a regular basis, the worry, the fear, you know, that kind of just stays with you, it got me thinking about the effects of the war on people back home.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved with Film Independence out in L.A., and I was in their mentoring program. And I had written like a single scene about two soldiers who were on their way to make a notification to a family.
Mm.
And my mentor, Carolyn McDonald, who has done a lot of HBO stuff, she is a producer. She's done, she used to run Danny Glover's production company.
Right.
So that was the connection there. She really liked it, and she was looking for a project to direct. So she thought that one scene could be expanded into a nice short.
Mm.
And so that's what we did. So the film follows two soldiers, one a little bit more experienced, one kind of brand new, as they kind of go through this day making three notifications.
Wow.
And
what do you feel about Hollywood's current tackling of the war in Iraq, how films have represented the war? There's been a few of them. Do you think that's something that's sorely lacking?
There's been a few of them. I can understand why there's not more, given the certain climate of it, given the time that it takes to produce a film.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to start seeing more about it coming out. I mean, we had Home of the Brave earlier.
Right.
On the TV front, you have, you know, shows like Army Wives. So I think that it's starting to gain momentum, more stories about the war. And although mine is about this current war, it's really about the effects of war period on family, on people at home. And it could have taken place during World War II. It could have taken place, you know, during the Civil War.
Right.
Because this is the reality in every war on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like a fascinating movie.
We're trying to get it online right now.
Oh, great, great.
Oh, cool.
If we get it online, I will definitely let you guys know.
And I think, too, I think Jerry and Chris and I have discussed this as well. I recently read an interview with Oliver Stone, who was planning a film on the conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he said, look, basically, I'd love to do a film about that, but the situation is changing on a daily basis.
Yeah,
we talked about that the other night.
Yeah, yeah, and you're absolutely right, Jerry. It's difficult to have any kind of... Any kind of take on the war when it's evolving so rapidly.
I know it is. It is.
Yeah. And you're also, Karen, you're also producing your first documentary.
Yes. I was actually just starting to work on the website. I'm still working on the name. I thought I had a name, but I've decided I don't love it. So.
Okay.
Back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
But the documentary is on women and body image issues.
Mm-hmm.
If you're familiar with the Dove campaign for Real Beauty.
Yes.
Where they have the real women in the ads.
Mm-hmm.
They've done some studies, and one of their studies showed that fully 50% of women have some sort of medium to severe body image issue. You know, for instance, I know a woman who cuts out her picture in every family photo.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because she doesn't think she's attractive enough to be in the picture with her family.
Mm.
And, you know, personally, I haven't worn a pair of shorts in over 10 years. Because I think my legs are that hideous.
How much do you think the media plays in our perception of ourselves?
Well, that's kind of what I want to look at in this film. One of the things I want to do is I want to profile three women with these issues. There are women that won't date. There are women that won't go to the doctor because of their own insecurities and their own issues.
Mm.
And when I tell people about this, they immediately think the focus is on overweight women. And while that might be true, you know, there's a lot of women who aren't overweight or who you look at on the street and wouldn't think would have these issues that actually have them.
Exactly, yeah.
And so in addition to kind of following these women as they sort of challenge themselves, I want to look at some of the perceptions, like, why do we all want to be a size zero?
Mm.
You know, that's the coveted Hollywood size to be now.
Yeah.
And it's designed to fit a 7-year-old girl.
True.
You know, so how realistic is that? I want to talk to men about it because I don't think, and you guys, you know, can correct me if I'm wrong, every man wants a woman that's a size zero.
No.
Not at all.
I will go on record right now and say that I happen to think those Dove ads are really hot. I'm the kind of guy that likes a girl with, little curves, you know. I think that every time I am flipping through a magazine and see one of those pictures of the Dove ads, and there's one of them that's got, like, I don't know, 8 or 9 of them standing in a row. It's like a double-page ad. Those chicks are hot. Like,
it's also very ironic how it is a soap commercial that gives you dirty thoughts.
Yeah, that's true. Very true.
That's just a joke. That's just a joke.
I think there needs to be more ads like the Dove ads. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
And so that's what the documentary is about. It's about bringing this issue to light. We see tons of documentaries on anorexia and bulimia, and while those things are important, they affect a very small minority of women.
Yeah.
True.
But body image issues affect over half of women.
I think they affect like both sexes, so I think it's body images.
Yeah.
Is actually a much bigger issue in males as well.
Yeah, I think it's particularly females. So
but females, no, definitely females, but it's also something that's prevalent in males too. So it's a very universal thing that you're making the thing on here.
Yeah, I'm interested. I'm definitely interested in seeing this film. Are you guys ready for our topic this week? We each chose three criminally underrated or three of our favorite films or three guilty pleasure films, and we're going to discuss them in a kind of roundtable setting. Karen, you're our guest of honor this evening. Would you like to give us your first movie pick?
Okay, my first movie pick, I went with three kind of guilty pleasures, three movies I could sort of watch all the time.
All right.
And they're so bizarre. You think of all three of them together, you're going to be like, what is wrong with that?
Don't worry, I have 40 I haven't picked yet.
So I think the first one would be whenever I'm sort of down or depressed, I watch The Birdcage.
Yes.
Oh, good choice.
With, you know, Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. And I guess because I'm a writer, one of the things about all three of my choices is I love the writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that script is just so funny.
It really is. We were watching it again just the other night. It was on cable, and we watched it again. And just, you're talking about a comedy that is perfectly timed and perfectly played. I mean, it's all about timing.
Everyone has wonderful timing.
Yeah, just from top to bottom, just great performances. Hank Azaria.
Mm.
He was great in that.
Hysterical in that movie. And he hasn't been able to find a film that brings out the best in him like The Birdcage did.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Exceptional movie. Your first pick is The Birdcage. Chris, give us your first pick.
All right, my first pick is Owning Mahoney with Philip Seymour.
Oh, yeah!
And it's about a guy with a gambling addiction. There's a lot of movies about addiction out there, you know, things like Requiem for a Dream come to mind. There's a lot of movies about drug addiction. But gambling addiction is, you know, it's prevalent too. There's a lot of people that become addicted to it, and it's just a movie about that. And no matter how fantastic it feels, no matter how great and cool you feel when you're gambling, and how what a rush it gives you, it's an addiction. And this movie just really plays that out.
Because you never feel more alive than when you're at the cusp of losing it all. It's almost like you're begging to lose it all. You know, that's,
yeah, and Philip Seymour Hoffman just delivers dynamite performance yet again. I mean, he always does. But
yeah,
one,
I mean...
Yeah, it's a great
really
performance.
Underrated.
Yeah, he's good in that, and John Hurt's really good in that.
Yes, as the casino owner, yes.
Yeah, and he's the director of that, made a wonderful movie with John Hurt before that, Love and Death in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, with Jason Priestley. Yeah.
That was very, I know, who would ever have thought? Those were great films.
It was good in it. It was a good movie, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, Jerry, what's your first choice?
Oh, well, you know, I have a pile of films that I brought out.
Just
and,
limit it,
you know, it's
kind of
like
three.
Russian roulette here at the Dennis household, so I'm just going to pick one, okay?
Okay.
I'm just going to put my hand in this pile, and I'm going to pick one. And... it's a VHS. Oh my God! Midnight Run.
Ah.
I love this film. Yes.
Yes.
It's one of these, and it's also a short film from the director Martin Brest. It doesn't go over 3 hours, but it's a wonderful film. I saw it actually in college, and I was not used to at the time seeing De Niro in a funny film. He's always a very serious actor.
I think this was his first big comedy.
Yeah, and
it was. Yeah.
And he and Charles Grodin were just great together.
Excellent. And Charles Grodin has never been better in a film. I know he's kind of retired now, semi-retired. He just did something with whatever that film was with Jason Bateman.
Oh, that movie's bloody awful, The X.
Yeah,
oh my
yeah.
God.
Oh yeah, that. Oh God.
I mean, I really. They handed out. They actually in the theater. They asked before you go in, "Do you want cyanide?" And I was like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about?"
Are we?
And then they did, and the two girls in front of me actually took it. So I don't know. I mean,
they probably really enjoyed the film then.
They weren't talking.
But Midnight Run and Charles Grodin in that, I think he is just hysterical. And my favorite part, it's just a little moment where they have the car chase and the helicopter shooting at them from above, and they crash under a little bridge there, and their car is totaled, and De Niro helps Grodin out of the car, and he's like, "Are you okay?" And Grodin says, "Oh, yes, I'm enjoying it." Like a throwaway line, but
yeah.
I laugh. It's a big belly laugh every time I see that film.
Yeah, he and Dennis Farina is good, and Joey Pants is good, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Good cast from top to bottom. I have chosen kind of three love stories, I guess you can call them.
You romantic.
Yeah, that's me. One of them is a very straightforward love story. The other two are a little more twisted, and they cover sexual desire. But my first choice, the traditional love story I've chosen, is The Bridges of Madison County.
Oh.
And I never in a million years thought that this movie would move me the way it did. I mean, the book is pretty thin. But the film, Clint Eastwood's film, it just empathized with the character so much. It is such a strong, powerful, realistic romance. And the themes about lost love and regret are just so much more vivid in this film than any other film I've seen similar to it. And it's one of those movies, it doesn't matter when I pop it in, when I start to watch it, it always gets to me by the end of it. There's a scene where Meryl Streep has chosen her husband over her affair with Clint Eastwood because she has responsibilities with her husband. Her husband's a good man. They have a family together, a life that they've established together. And he's on his deathbed, and Meryl Streep lies next to him, and he says something to the effect of, "I know you've sacrificed a lot to be with me, to make me happy. I know you've sacrificed your dreams," and it kills me. It slays me. I'm a puddle on the floor. I'm girly like that. But that's my first choice. Bridges of Madison County.
Good choice.
Yeah, that's one of the few films that actually is better than the book.
Much better. Yes. And it adds a whole sense of depth that the book doesn't even touch. And it's just a great movie. And Meryl Streep, what can you say? And Clint Eastwood, as a director and as a performer in that film, just the top of his game, just amazing. So, Karen, what is your second choice for tonight?
My second choice is, and I saw this movie for the first time when I was 12, A Clockwork Orange.
Oh. You don't get much better than that.
And it's sort of, as like 12-year-old trying to stay up late and like sneak and watch HBO.
Yes.
It sort of like blew my mind.
Mm. Yeah, that's one way to, yeah.
And I've been like fascinated with that movie ever since. And every time you see it, you know, it's a lot of Kubrick. It has so many layers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much there that every time you see it, you get something else out of it.
That's very true.
It's typical Kubrick. I think, you know, I'm not the biggest Kubrick fan, as Jerry and Chris know, but I think that is one of his undeniably great films. That film works for me almost better than anything else in his resume because it does exactly what it sets out to do. And you're right. You get something new from it every time you watch it, and it's horrifying. It's kind of savagely funny.
And it's compelling the whole time, though. It's like, no matter what, you can't really turn away from it.
That's true.
And I think Kubrick was just fine with the viewer watching his movies and not knowing what to feel. I think he was going for that kind of challenging ambiguity in his work. And you're right, Clockwork Orange is a phenomenal film. Chris, what's your second choice for this evening?
My second choice is David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers with Jeremy Irons.
Ooh. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Because it is, every time I watch it, I like disturbing movies. You know, I like movies like Happiness and Requiem for a Dream and things like that. And this movie, but, you know, a lot of people, it kind of came and went, and it was...
It has a great line in it.
What's that?
I want Chris to finish, then I'll go into that one.
No, I mean, it's got lots of great lines. And it also has, there's been lots of performances by actors playing two parts, you know, like twins in a movie like Nicolas Cage, which is another good one. But I don't think there's ever been a better one than Jeremy Irons' performance in this
movie. It's fantastic.
It all rides on Jeremy Irons' performance, too.
Oh, my God.
He's amazing.
The movie's just so disturbing, and by the end of it, you feel so freaking dirty that you need to go take a shower.
And I feel that way watching Clockwork Orange too.
Yeah.
but Cronenberg, I mean, that's the top of his game right there, Dead Ringers.
Yeah.
And it deals with a lot of those themes that fascinate Cronenberg too.
Yeah, and it's kind of loosely based on actual events too.
Yes, it is. That's right.
Yeah.
These two twin gynecologist doctors who kind of just descended into madness because of their lifestyles, and that makes it all the more disturbing. The final sequence of the movie is just so disturbing that I can't even watch without going to take a bath afterwards.
Okay, Jerry, what's
well, I'm going to first go with the line that I like in that film a lot, and it actually leads right to my next film.
Okay.
Genevieve Bijol says, "This is the most embarrassing thing I've ever been involved with," and Jeremy Irons like, "I seriously doubt that." And so that leads us to The House of Yes with Parker Posey, which I believe is probably her best role.
Hmm.
And I don't know if anyone's seen that on here. Have you, or have I just picked one out of nowhere?
I saw it.
Where she's like Jackie O?
Yeah, she's like Jackie O, but it's one of these roles early on when she was still really a darling of the independent film scene before she discovered You've Got Mail and Josie and the Pussycats and that sort of thing. And she just gives a tour de force performance in this film. And Genevieve Lee is old as her mother, and they have these reenactments of the Kennedy assassination, and there's incest, and it's the quintessential dysfunctional comedy of the 1990s. And it's a brilliant little film. I saw it when I was in Seattle on vacation, and it's just really well done. And it also boasts something that's an oddity, a good performance from Tori Spelling.
Yes, that's always an event.
Oh, well, no, it is. I mean, you know, you think Tori Spelling, and she actually got good notices for that. You're like thinking, wait a second, did the Russians win the Cold War?
I think that's a sign of the apocalypse.
I think, you know, I thought it was like a parallel universe kind of thing, but...
But she's a very, not Tori Spelling, but Parker Posey. She's a very kind of odd, off-center presence in films. And when she's used well, it's just magical.
Yes, it is. When a
director and the right material taps into her special quality, it's excellent. My second pick is a Mike Nichols film. You know, he's been making movies for a long time, and he's getting up there in age. But you know, it's exceptional director when so late in his career he makes a film as vital and alive as Closer.
Oh,
this is a great relationship film. Just brutal and honest and just so well acted. Clive Owen, Julia Roberts, Natalie Portman, Jude Law. It's based on a stage play, I believe.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of meat in this movie. There's a lot of substance to this movie, and I just found it so realistic and believable the way these relationships twisted under each character's insecurity.
The dialogue in that movie is just so
fantastic.
Yeah, oh, it's magnificent.
You can tell that it comes from
people,
a stage play.
Two people are so close to one another, the hurtful, awful things they can say to each other, it's so realistic. It's
yeah.
So true.
And you can tell it comes from a stage play because it has that excellent dialogue, but unlike other versions of stage plays, it transcends. I mean, it is fully a film.
Yeah.
So that's my second pick is Closer.
And it's just Clive Owen's performance. It's such a thundering presence on the screen. I mean, it's a powerhouse, like Richard Burton-esque performance.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Karen, what is your, I guess we're up to the third choice now. Karen, are you there? Oh.
Hello?
I think we've lost Karen.
Oh, no.
We lost Karen. Karen has been replaced by a windstorm at this point.
I will, I think we've lost her. Let me pick up the line again. Karen, are you there? Okay, we've lost the connection. Hopefully she'll call back in and that line will clear up soon. And we can get her back on our show here. We have a phone call from an 817 area code. Let's take that real quick. 817, go right ahead.
Hey, guys, it's John from the Dead Air Show.
Hey,
John. How are you?
Oh, doing great. I appreciate you taking the call. I know you guys want to get to your list. I just want to touch on a couple of mine. Real quick, you're talking about Closer, though, just a really quick piece of trivia. You know, in the stage version, Clive Owen played the Jude Law part.
Yes. Yes.
And one of my favorite lines of any movie actually comes from Closer. There's a part where Clive Owen is so pissed off at Jude Law's character fighting over Julia Roberts. And Clive Owen just, right before he gets up from his desk in anger, he goes, you know what a heart looks like? It looks like a fist wrapped in blood.
Yes. Yes.
And
that
I love that line. That line should define the entire movie.
It does.
It does.
It's
yes.
A good one.
So what are your choices?
Well, I have three ones real quick. One would be Mike Judge's Idiocracy. If anyone hasn't seen this movie yet, it got dumped into like three theaters.
Yeah,
it was delayed forever.
Horribly.
Yeah.
It did, and I the only reason I even knew about it is I was walking in Blockbuster and I saw the really horrible box art for it, and I was like, "Is this the movie?" And it was, and it's hysterical. It's not the smartest movie, it's not the best acting, but it is one of the funniest. It's right up there with Office Space. I think it needs to find a new audience.
I think it has a great premise too.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. A lot of people may avoid it because they think it's just a left-leaning movie that makes fun of the Bush administration, and it really doesn't. It's more of a condemnation of just stupid people. And I think they make, like, one joke about Fox News, and that's about it
yeah.
for, like, you know, a political view.
Right.
The next would be Pleasantville.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that film.
Now, that is one of the best movies. It didn't get noticed that much in theaters. I remember noticing that. But the last scene of that movie, which is not to blow it for anyone who hasn't seen it that's listening, if you guys can remember, with William H. Macy, Jeff Daniels, and Joan Allen on a park bench, and the last line, and it's just perfect.
Yeah, it's a great film. It's one of those films that got such great critical notices, but it didn't translate into people going to see it, you know,
yeah,
and buying tickets for it. It's a great
Gary
film.
Ross, he needs to make more movies.
Yeah, he really does.
Exactly.
What's your third movie? And then
you know what? I don't know why I'm blanking, but I am blanking on my third movie now.
John, come on! Don't let us down like that. It's Wednesday night.
I have no idea. I'm just sitting here trying to figure out, you know, like how to rush through because I know you guys got a show to do.
Karen has called us back, so we're going to bring her back on. But John, what's up for this weekend's Dead Air show? This Sunday.
Well, this weekend, I'm on a little bit of a hiatus. If anybody heard, I was on briefly last Sunday with a couple of prank phone calls. I have another prank phone call we're going to be playing that I made, so expect that this Sunday. As for what my two buddies there, Alex and Matt, have planned, I have yet to see exactly what they're going to have going on. But as always, we try to bring the funny to you. It's going to be Sunday.
You do a great job every week, and I'm glad you're back on.
It's going to be Sunday right after our show at 7 p.m. Eastern. It's a great show.
That's correct. It's thedeadairshow.com. It'll take you to everything you need to know. And if I remember what that movie was, I'll try to call you back before your show's over.
Thank you,
John.
All right, guys.
Bye-bye now. Okay, we have Karen back with us.
When my cell phone is more reliable than my regular phone.
That's good. Thank you so much for calling us back. We want to hear your third pick.
Okay, my third pick is from one of my all-time favorite actresses.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, if you're in your 30s or 40s, you know her from being in tabloids and being married 7 times.
Mm.
But back in the day, Liz Taylor was the bomb.
Oh, yeah. I mean, who doesn't
know
that?
She was beautiful. She was the first actress to ever get $1 million for a film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that film, unfortunately, was Cleopatra, but...
Hey,
you got to do it somewhere.
You got to
start somewhere. But I can always, always, always watch Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
You are a beautiful human being.
I mean, she in that movie is so radiant, and Paul Newman.
Oh, yeah.
And it's based on the Tennessee Williams play, and it actually has a slightly happier ending than in the play.
Yeah. Tennessee Williams is absolutely one of my favorite playwrights.
How can I compete with a Clockwork Orange and that cat came to Can I hang up now?
Yeah, well, we're done after those great hits. Those were exceptional. Tennessee Williams was just an incredible writer.
I loved her in Giant. That was the first thing I saw.
He was such a great writer of female characters.
Yes, and she did several of them because she also did A Place in the Sun.
Now, A Place in the Sun is just one of the best. That and Giant, I always felt, were her best,
mm-hmm.
like for me at least, her best roles.
Yeah, those are amazing. Chris, what is your third choice?
Well, I can't believe I'm going to follow up Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with it, but it's a guilty pleasure of mine. It's Running Scared. It's not the Paul Walker Running Scared.
It's the Billy Crystal one, baby.
It's the Billy Crystal Gregory Hines Running Scared, one of my all-time favorite movies. In my opinion, the best buddy cop movie ever made.
Wow.
That's a bold statement.
It's just so much fun. It's so funny. Like, every time I watch it, I just laugh. I don't know. Maybe it's because it's a movie I love from childhood. But
yeah.
These two, they were such a great pair. They should have made another one. Unfortunately, Gregory Hines passed away. But it really is so funny. It's such a funny movie. I love it.
I rewatched that again recently. I had an old videotape of it that I bought probably 15 years ago. So I pulled it out knowing how much you love it, and I watched it. It's a very entertaining movie. They have remarkable chemistry with one another.
Yeah.
And you know, I even like you do, this is why it's a guilty pleasure, the cheesy 80s Running Scared theme song that plays.
Oh, my God, it's so horrible. It's so horrible that it's great.
That's why it's great, because it plays like that. Chris,
Joey Pants in that one, too.
Yeah, Jerry, and Stephen Bauer is in that film, too. And
that's right, yes, he is.
We interviewed him for the Pacino show. Jerry, what's your third pick?
Okay, you know, you're going to be really flattered because I'm going to try to quote from your review from this film. So,
mine?
Yes, yours. Yes, your review of this. It's an Australian film from 2005. It's called The Proposition.
Mm.
Yes.
And I'm going to quote from Jamie DeVal's review. Well, a paraphrase, not quote. It is the first time in Danny Houston's life that he lives up to his last name.
Oh.
And that is from your review, my friend. Don't say I didn't read everything you wrote, but I did.
That was pretty good.
And the proposition is not only is an Australian Western that deals with the colonialism in the 19th century with the Aborigines, it's just one of the best films I saw that year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got Guy Pearce, Ray Winstone, Danny Houston, John Hurt, and Emily Watson. It's a film that's worth your time. If you love Sergio Leone Westerns or Sam Peckinpah Westerns, this is the film for you. It's got the action, but more importantly, think of the proposition as the Australian equivalent of Apocalypse Now and Heart of Darkness with Danny Houston playing the Colonel Kurtz part, and you're in for a great time.
That's a good analogy.
Written by Nick Cave, too.
Yes, Nick Cave, one of our finest musicians. So.
Yeah, and it's a very down and dirty, kind of gritty Western.
And
the same year of the Three Burials of Milquiades Estradas.
That's right.
Which I think is just exceptional.
It is.
These were two of the best, among the best films of that year. My third choice is a controversial film, even though I think it's definitely attained classic status and belongs there. It still, I believe, is an NC-17. It's an X-rated film. And that is The Last Tango in Paris, which I consider to be Marlon Brando's finest performance. It's just an open wound of a performance.
Easily his best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an amazingly honest look about this twisted sexual relationship and all these films that pretend to be be daring about sex, like The Basic Instincts and this kind of thing. They don't express anything. They don't allow the sexuality to define the characters. I mean, they don't explore that element of it. Last Tango in Paris, the characters are so well-defined, and the sex is an expression of what they're going through and what demons they're fighting. Very honest, very brutal, and I know that people always talk about the butter scene, but you guys know about the butter scene, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know about the butter scene.
Yeah.
Yes. But it's just an amazingly honest, expressive movie. Bertolucci directed it, and it's beautiful. If you pay attention to the camera work as well, the camera work almost plays like a tango. It kind of sweeps in and out. It's very dramatic, and even the colors in the film, the color of the walls in the hotel room where they meet every afternoon, as the movie progresses, the colors get more and more fleshy. They get pinker and pinker. And you feel it. It has a cumulative, subtle effect on you. So I think that is an exceptional movie. That's my third choice, Last Tango in Paris. Okay, so that's it for me. You guys feel happy with your choices? Some really good choices tonight.
Do we have another hour? I have some more.
I just have to make one correction, because Tennessee Williams didn't do A Place in the Sun. I was thinking of Suddenly Last Summer.
That's right. But
Was it August Wilson that did A Place? Or
no,
that was
A Place
Raisin
in the Sun, I want to say, it's based on an American tragedy. With
Theodore.
Right.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We had a great time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.
It was a pleasure. It was a great time.
You are welcome to come back on the show anytime. When you get this this documentary up and going and you have something to report to us, please call us back and let us know.
Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Karen Beach. Her website is divasoulsista.com. Let me take this call real quick. I think it might be John back with his flick pick. John, are you there?
Yes, I remembered.
Go ahead.
Man Bites Dog.
Oh, that's a good one, man.
I'm hoping you guys remember that. French movie, black and white.
I do remember.
Yeah.
I want to say mid-90s. And, you know, this movie came out before Blair Witch. And I wish, nobody mentioned this movie in any of the reviews or anything. And Blair Witch came out, which is a phenomenal movie. Nobody mentioned Man Bites Dog. And it's a documentary that follows a French serial killer. It's actually a very great movie. It's very disturbing, but it has a very disturbing ending. But I mean, before Blair Witch, you got this crew following around a serial killer, and you watch as, of course, you know what you would expect him in the act. and everybody that plays the crew to the boom mic guy, they're the actual boom mic guys, they're the actual sound guys. It's very, very well done, very neat. I would recommend finding the actual subtitled version, because the dubbed version is horrible.
Well, you know, they have
an edition of it on DVD. Criterion released one a year ago, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Criterion release, and they're
well, good, good, because I haven't had a chance to seek it out yet. But.
Well, thank you, John, for letting us know about your third choice, and that's a good
one. Hey, thanks for having me join in, man. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, man. Bye-bye now. We have one more caller, and obviously we're running over. This last segment of the show will be for the benefit of our archive listeners, but let's take this 260 area code call. 260, go right ahead.
Ah, this is Mark. How's it going?
Hey,
oh,
how you doing?
The man, the myth, the legend, yes! Oh, yeah, it's me. I just was listening to the show and kind of got cut off at the end, so I, with the overtime, so I just thought I'd go and call you up and, listen to it.
Well, do you have a guilty pleasure? Do you have a favorite film that's
kind of a
guilty?
He has the 200 greatest films of all time.
Oh, thank you.
That's true. Give us one.
I got, too many guilty pleasures. I think that's what I run on. I got to go with the Bruce Campbell Boba Hotep.
Yeah, baby!
It's just such a weird collection of characters. I forget who did the short story, but...
Joe Lansdale, I think. Joe R. Lansdale?
Yeah. That sounds right.
Now, when is that sequel coming out? I keep hearing talk about a one that involves vampires or something.
Something like that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Baba Nosferatu, they want to call it. And they wanted to get Paul Giamatti, was totally willing to play Colonel Tom Parker in it. He was signed on to do it. I don't know what happened with that. I hope Don Coscarelli will do it. But
I hope so, too.
That would
be a great choice. And another thing about that movie, the DVD has a commentary track with Bruce Campbell doing Elvis watching the movie.
I'm going to Best Buy tomorrow to get that.
Oh, you got to listen to it, man, because it's a whole new dimension to the movie. He doesn't even recognize that there's this actor named Bruce Willis playing Elvis. It's Elvis watching this ridiculous movie. Hysterical. Totally hysterical. And the movie's great, too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling in, man. I appreciate your call.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. It's a pleasure to hear your voice.
Oh, no problem.
Bye-bye now. All right, we've gone about almost 10 minutes over, but we're all done for this Wednesday evening. We appreciate everyone listening in tonight, and our guest Karen Beach, the Diva Soul Sister. We'll be back Sunday night. Look for a big announcement in the next couple of days concerning who our guest might possibly be for Sunday night. We'll also be discussing the best TV shows on Sunday evening on the second half of that show, so tune in for that. Guys, thanks so much for doing the show with us tonight. It's a great time.
I had an awesome time. Thank you.
And we will see everybody on Sunday. Good night now.
Good night. Bye-bye.